Welcome back to the Tag Sustainability Talk podcast. We've got a little twist for you today. Rick Wren will be standing in and hosting a two-part episode discussing nuclear energy with Nick Irvin, Director of Advanced Energy Systems R&D for Southern Company. Nick will share his journey from growing up in Birmingham, Alabama, to becoming a leader in nuclear energy. We'll discuss the role of nuclear power in creating a sustainable future, advancements in technology, and the potential of molten salt reactors. Join us as we explore how nuclear energy could help decarbonize our energy system and provide reliable power for generations to come.
Welcome, everybody. So on today's episode, we're speaking with Nick Irvin, Director of Advanced Energy Systems R&D for Southern Company. Nick, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
If you don't mind, let's get right to it. Let's start a little bit about with your story and your background. What drew you to this space, especially as it relates to nuclear energy?
Well, yeah, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. So I'm a Alabama boy, born and raised in the suburbs of Birmingham, out in the countryside, little hobby farm, and grew up working a lot with my hands and knew I was going to be an engineer, found my way to chemical engineering. And as a guy in Alabama, you sort of always wanted to work at the power company. Ended up finding my way into environmental work, trying to really impact the planet, make things better, and eventually into R&D, where I was able to use sort of my natural curiosity and interest in how things work and able to apply it to our business and bringing new technologies into the business. And so I've been doing that R&D work for about 25 years, worked on a lot of environmental issues around our operating fleet, from how we do things like create beneficial uses of ash all the way to how we manage carbon. And about a decade ago, started looking really hard into our long-term future and just came to the conclusion that if we really want to find a sustainable, abundant future where we have all the energy we want to do all the things we want, nuclear had to be a part of the solution. And so really started diving in deep on developing new nuclear technologies at about a decade ago, and have been doing it ever since.
So been involved for a good decade here in the nuclear industry. I'm sure, of course, you were heavily involved with the Vogtle project here within the Southern Company. What gets you so excited about nuclear? Obviously, there's the decarbonizing aspects of it. I'm sure the energy density portion of it is worthwhile. Anything else worth elaborating on?
Yeah, I think when I first started looking at nuclear, it was sort of this question. We're trying to answer the question, how do we create abundance? How do we create energy for all in a way that could be affordable, sustainable? And, you know, there's a lot of room for different technologies in the portfolio. We have a large energy system, but just when you look at sort of fundamentals of how much energy we need, a fuel supply, it being a capacity, a dispatchable capacity. But I think also as a technologist, it was something along the lines of there's still a lot of good that we can extract out of what's coming from nuclear. So Vogtle is a tremendous accomplishment. We learned a lot at that site, and that technology is a wonderful technology. But if I zoom out a little bit, the base technology that is the Vogtle units, we call a light water reactor, is sort of the first shot on goal for nuclear. And when you look at the space that's in front of us, the empty space, there's a lot of opportunity to not only make great strides, but also to serve customers, to serve people very differently. So going back to the beginning of the journey, it was energy sits at the foundation of the quality of life of everybody on the planet. How do I deliver that energy in a way that is sort of unlimited in its usefulness? And that just sort of led us straight into this thing we call advanced nuclear.
So this is touching on really the meat of our conversation today, Nick, and I'm actually very excited to learn more about this advanced nuclear topic. But before we get there, I want to talk a little bit about kind of the short-term outlook, so to speak, for nuclear across the U.S. grid. Advanced nuclear, please correct me if I'm wrong, but that's probably a little more long-term. Short-term, are we looking at potentially any more AP1000s, very, very similar to Vogtle's units 3 and 4, on the U.S. grid, and what role and what capacity will they play?
I certainly hope so. We learned a lot of things at Vogtle. We made a lot of progress. We now have a design that has been not only certified, but built and is operating. And if you look at the challenges of what we went through at Vogtle, we already saw cost reductions from one unit to the next. We expect the next group that takes that up would be able to leverage that even further going forward. And when you just look at the scale of the opportunity that's in front of us, we're in an unprecedented place with data center growth. Basically, if you listen to the data center guys, compute equals electrons. And the growth that we're seeing is on the order of the kind of growth that we saw when we put air conditioning in every home in the late 20th century in the South. Tens of gigawatts coming to grids all over the country. We certainly need large-scale nuclear power like the AP1000, and it'd be a shame if we didn't take advantage of everything we learned and built more of them. So I'm optimistic that we will. I think the industry is studying that right now. Basically, every week there's a new conference or conversation happening at the national level about how do we get alignment between AI data center load growth and the ability to deliver large nuclear power, of which I think the AP1000 is the right one. So yeah, and you're right, advanced nuclear is really that transformational technology that we probably still need another good solid decade, 15 years, maybe 20 years, depending on the technology to get there. But it holds the key and it unlocks a lot of opportunity. So that's why in R&D, we're so interested in it.
Well, let's learn a little bit more. Very, very excited to dive into this topic. Advanced nuclear, if you could give us a little bit of background tutorial real quick on what you're referring to in terms of advanced nuclear or generation 4, gen 4 type reactors.
For sure. So a little history lesson here. If you go all the way back to the beginning of the atomic age, but prior to the DOE, we had in this country, coming off the heels of the Manhattan Project, an enormous amount of science. In the 1950s and 60s, we built 52 reactors at what was called the reactor test site, but it's now Idaho National Lab, where we tested basically any kind of configuration of a nuclear reactor you could imagine and explored all the fundamental physics and basically made the decision. And this was largely led by a guy named Hyman Rickover, who was an admiral, who said that the Navy likes light water reactors because, well, we have lots of water around when we're in the boat in the ocean. And then the energy industry, the electricity industry and nuclear really grew up out of the naval programs. We saw the proliferation of the light water reactor that is in our existing fleet, of which we have between 90 and 100 operating reactors domestically, and globally, many, many more than that. But that would have been what we would have so-called a Gen 2 reactor. The AP1000 is what we would call a Gen 3 or Gen 3 plus. Largely all of that is still operating on the basis of water as a coolant, usually oxide fuel, solid fuel, moderated with the water. That's sort of the basic form factor that you get. There's all kinds of different ways in which you can engineer that, but that's the basic physics. The so-called advanced reactors or Gen 4 reactors, I really characterize as when we move beyond water as a coolant. And way back when, we did enormous testing of a lot of these. Some of them were commercialized. There were commercial activities associated with something called a sodium fast reactor, which uses sodium as a coolant. There are commercial activities around high temperature gas reactors, which use things like helium and a high pressure vessel to cool the core. They all have their different benefits. But fundamentally, advanced reactors is sort of the movement into, I would say, non-water coolants, and then typically advanced fuel forms. That the combination of those two things bring something relative to safety or performance characteristics or fuel cycle characteristics, or maybe a combination of all of those that can really take the technology base up to the next level in terms of markets and ultimately cost and performance. When I talk about it in terms of what we do at Southern, we've done a lot of surveying of all those, and we generally stay in touch with all those, but we really spend a lot of time on one specific type of advanced reactor, something called a molten salt reactor, which is a really, really cool design. I'm a chemical engineer, and it's sort of the chemical engineering reactor. The first thing that you do is you say, well, in a light water reactor, you never want to talk about a meltdown, which is where you lose the ability to cool the core and the fuel melts down. And that's something, we do a lot of work on passive safety and all the things to create the safety conditions in those machines. Well, in a molten salt reactor, we just say, hey, well, you know what we're going to do? We're going to make the fuel liquid. And by making the fuel liquid, by putting in a salt, you get enormous safety benefits. First, the reactor is always in that form looking for its safest condition automatically with physics. So you can make a few decisions here and you put the physics in control, and then the reactor sort of takes care of itself, which is a really unique way to think about nuclear physics.
So molten salt, to summarize a little bit.
Yeah, please.
Essentially, you're embedding fissionable material within a fluid environment, a molten salt environment.
Yep.
And there are kind of self-regulating, quote unquote, pathways by fluidizing the fissional material within these reactors. Is that a fair statement to make?
Yeah, thanks for helping me get it summarized there. So the first things first, we are going to use a salt, and the salts are like table salt. What's really cool about them is they don't melt until very high temperatures, which means they also don't have a high pressure. So you can operate in an environment that's very low pressure. But you dissolve the fuel into the salt as a chloride. And what's really cool there is you have the ability to move the fuel in and out of the core real time. And also you get something called a density feedback, which means the fuel expands and contracts with temperature. Those are the kinds of things that almost all liquids do, right? You can move liquids with pumps in and out of vessels. They expand and contract with temperature. But in the case of nuclear physics, that expansion and contraction means that the reactor will self-regulate because the density is a primary contributor to whether or not the core is critical. So said in very, very simple terms, if you have a really bad day and you can't take heat out of the core will turn itself off. And so that's a very different paradigm shifting sort of environment. The other thing that that means is that the core will make as much power as you take from it. So you can actually develop a core that is load following, which is a big deal for us, that is absolutely just goes where the load wants it to go. If you zoom back out one more step from that, this fundamental characteristic means that I can achieve unmatched levels of safety and very simple systems. And that really addresses the cost picture of nuclear. If the physics yield the safety without having to have layers and layers and layers of engineering, then that means I can get cost way out of the plant. And so that's the promise of a machine like this.
So we're talking about potentially not only safety fission for the grid, we're talking about potentially lower cost, even safer fission-produced electricity for the grid.
Yes. And back to your history lesson, there's some reports that are out there from the 1950s. When they surveyed this entire environment, they said, the first one that we should do is the light water reactor because we have the easiest line of sight to get it done. But the ultimate one is this molten salt reactor because of its cost of performance benefits inherent with all of the physics of the safety case. So it's something we've sort of known for a long time. We've just needed to do the R&D necessary to get it there. That's still where we are.
So basically, we're currently treading the roadmap to get to the most optimal design for nuclear.
That's right.
Within the U.S. Very exciting stuff. You mentioned a term, criticality.
Right.
Could you elaborate a little further on that? Just for our listeners?
Yeah. The way I think about it is with a nuclear, again, I'm a chemical engineer. I think about it in sort of chemical reactor terms, but a nuclear reactor, in order to be critical, which basically means you are in a self-sustaining fission reaction, you have to get the combination of a volume. You have to get the fuel in that volume. And then you have to get the probability that the neutrons are going to interact with that fuel correct. And so that sort of three-pronged optimization problem is different. Say for a light water reactor, we put solid fuel inside a core and it has a certain sort of fuel density. And then we put water in it and that water is called a moderator. It increases the probability that the fuel fissions and that way it can be critical. Different fuel forms, different volumes, different moderators or not require different combinations of each of those three. But ultimately, what you're trying to do is meet that criteria in this reactor, propagate the fissions events, and then that ultimately produces the heat that you drag out the back in order to turn into power. So it's a very specific term associated with nuclear physics. It basically just means you've met the criteria for a sustainable fission reaction.
Creating a controlled chain reaction.
That's right. Yep,
now,
that's
very, very succinct definition.
Yeah, well said.
Understood. Yes, sir. If you could enumerate just a little further on this, you mentioned some other potential non-light water coolant systems, such as sodium, such as high-pressure gas like helium. What happened with the research on those type of methodologies? Are they still ongoing, or does really the molten salt look to be the most bang for our buck?
No, there's certainly a lot of work still ongoing on that. Sodium fast reactors were first demonstrated, or really precursor to the DOE, the Atomic Energy Commission. And today there's actually a demonstration plant being built by one of our partners just on another product of theirs, TerraPower, in Kenmare, Wyoming. Sodium, I wouldn't recommend anybody to go try to to get some liquid sodium metal. It likes to burn, likes to react with a lot of stuff, including water and air. But it's a really, really good coolant. It has amazing thermal conductivity, thermal heat capacity. And so if you're trying to cool something, it's the top of the line. So that project has sort of coming to a culmination with a demonstration, and they hope to be able to go into a commercial environment the next decade and offer those for sale. That has also been done in France and in Japan with that reactor type. We're monitoring that. We wish them well. The gas reactors, the high temperature gas reactors, use helium. Similar story there. There's been a lot of those built around the world. Right now, there is a demonstration project that is going in a Dow chemical refinery in Texas. I mentioned earlier, a lot of these Gen 4 reactors have the potential to expand the use case into different markets. And so the company called X Energy is building a reactor for Dow. It uses a very special fuel form of uranium and helium as a coolant. And the interesting thing there is they can go to, because helium is a coolant and because of the fuel form, they can go to really high temperatures that are only really available to gas reactors and molten salt reactors. And so Dow, as a chemical refiner, is really looking for that high temperature to support sort of eliminating the combustion of natural gas from their facilities. So those two are domestic. If I look more globally, the Chinese, they have a very robust program. They're building lots of light water reactors. And, you know, we partner with them in support of the AP1000 design, but they're continuing that out. But they are building high temperature gas reactors today. The Russians have robust sodium fast reactor product they offer. So globally, there's still a lot of work going on across the entire space of these different reactor types, these different Gen 4 types.
So these Gen 4 types, in particular, the high pressure gas you mentioned earlier, probably even sodium and molten chloride, opening up to potential more formats for nuclear. When I hear that, I'm thinking, yes, utility scale, but not so much utility scale, maybe more intermediate type scale. Call it commercial and industrial. CNI is the terminology.
Sure.
A lot.
That's right.
Maybe even some designs that involve more modularity, not just large gigawatt plus size structures. Structures that are maybe in the sub 100 megawatt range,
sure.
So to speak.
Sure.
Very, very interesting. So let's talk a little bit about where you're at in terms of these molten chloride reactors.
Sure.
Obviously, we're not market ready yet. What's the pathway forward? What's the roadmap look like?
So our primary program around the molten salt reactor is something called the molten chloride fast reactor. And that is a partnership with a company called TerraPower. TerraPower is a Gates Ventures company. I mentioned earlier they have two products. One is the sodium fast reactor, and then there's this molten chloride fast reactor. We started working with them in 2013, very early days, on trying to understand the potential of this design. And along the way, have done a lot of work on what we call separate and integrated effects tests, which basically means something like, what's the smallest experiment I can do to find out what it takes to break something? So as an example, we built these tiny little flow loops. If you put salt in water, it can be a very corrosive environment. What we're trying to do is figure out, can you actually take pure salt and put it in a metal and flow it around at 1,000, 1,200, 1,400 degrees Fahrenheit? What are the metal solutions for that? So we've been doing a lot of work sort of on the fundamentals of how you pump, flow, move heat in and out of, build piping systems with TerraPower in a non-nuclear environment, so literally electric heaters. That work has been going extremely well. Then about 5 years ago, we said, you know, it's time to transition into the nuclear physics world. And so we can model a lot of the safety case, but in nuclear, modeling's not enough. You need to go do the experiments. And we have built now a program around the idea of going to the national lab and building the absolute smallest size reactor we can build to keep it as cheap as possible, but with the focus of how do we demonstrate the necessary data, gather the data, demonstrate the performance to validate all our models so that we can actually say when we go into licensing space, we know how this will behave and we have the data to demonstrate it. And so that's where we are right now. We've sort of got this body of work in the electrically heated pumps, pipes, and parts so I can engineer it. And we're developing this body of work that's in the nuclear physics. One of my colleagues likes to say, we're going to kick it in the teeth and watch it smile at us. The reactor is extremely stable, and we're going to go do the experiments in a highly controlled environment at the National Lab setting where we did 52 of these before and gather all that physics data. As we go beyond that, you know, I'm a big believer in the idea of you got to begin with the end in mind. And so we know we can't commercialize this alone. The utility industry is a big industry, but we have an affordability responsibility. And so we've worked really hard to build a big club, as it were, of people we can partner with. One of the more interesting parts of this story that I really love is about 5 or 6 years ago, we started getting a knock on the door from a startup company in the maritime industry. And you think, well, maritime, what's that got to do with anything? Well, the maritime industry represents a $3 to $5 trillion global trade commercial operation. They're sailing at the slowest speeds in their history since they swapped from sails to steam. And a lot of that is on the back of environmental constraints globally driving efficient operation or trying to basically reduce their fuel consumption. And that is putting friction in global trade. And so they're looking for a solution. One of the things that becomes very clear is, you know, nuclear propulsion could be a great enabler for the next transition phase of the naval industry. But the light water reactor, what our navies use today, doesn't work very well for a lot of different reasons. The two biggest ones are insurability. You got to be able to have a safety case that shrinks the boundary so that you're not having an insurability problem. And then the second one is fuel cycle. You got to have a long enough fuel cycle aboard a boat that you're not having to distribute nuclear fuel throughout the world in every port. Well, the molten salt reactor actually turns out to be a really ideal solution for that. And so they came knocking at our door representing 65% of non-Chinese global shipyards capacity and about 5,000 operating vessels on the sea. So what does that mean? Well, our program going forward needed a big market and it needed the ability to partner in a big way with these markets. And we need predictable, cost-effective manufacturing and construction sea shipyards. The challenge we've had as an industry is how do I get an order book big enough to see a shipyard built for it? Well, when I walk in over here, the maritime team, and they say, well, we might need a few thousand of these things. It looks very similar to what we might want a few hundred of. Well, suddenly now we have an order book potential and an investor group that we can partner with that I think can allow us to get the industrial logic right to actually build momentum on sequential serial construction in a highly quality controlled environment in a cost-effective environment that we can actually see that cost curve come down, which is what I mentioned earlier with the AP1000, you know, what we all want as a nuclear industry. Last thing I'll say there is just this idea of the maritime industry coming in to invest and help drag us forward. It's a very analogous idea to our industry and what we saw. If you're familiar with the utility industry, we do a lot of work with what we call large frame gas turbines. Well, the makers of large frame gas turbines got their start making turbines for aircraft. And if you look at that industry, the broad base of manufacturing and material science and all the things is shared between those two industries. And so I think it's a model that has worked. Gas turbines creating large frame turbines and the shared infrastructure. So I don't think it's as crazy an idea as it sounds, is that maybe the right way to go forward is in partnership with a large volume industry that we can leverage each other in terms of making this thing work well.
A lot of great content right there. Let me try to summarize
sure.
best I can. Essentially, you and TerraPower partnered up and a couple years ago really figured out the mechanics and fluid dynamics of these molten chloride reactors. Now it's an issue of going to the DOE-run national laboratories, maybe getting a couple more parties on board to de-risk everything and figure out how you can incorporate fission into these mechanics and dynamics of molten chloride.
That's right.
Now you are also building up a soon-to-be-viable market for these molten chloride reactors, in particular with the maritime industry.
Yes.
So it seems like you're tackling all the appropriate necessary facets of this process to make a viable product. Is that a fair statement?
I don't know. You tell me. I hope so. I'm working really hard at it. My team is working really, really hard. We pride ourselves on really defining the problem and trying to make sure that we're not having giant gaps in the execution delivery of the solution. The only thing we haven't talked about is the world of licensing, which I'm happy to do that. But that's another critically important step as we transition into this Gen 4 environment. You always have to begin with the end in mind, and the market can't be an afterthought. How you deliver cost effectively to the market has to be at the front.
Special thanks to Jennifer Zeller for hosting the interview at the Georgia Experience Center down at Georgia Tech. Don't forget to keep an eye out on the TAG website for the second part of the interview in 3 weeks.